Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post, Thomas Ricks, delivered a debate-changing judgment on the Iraq War last year with his hugely influential book, Fiasco. Ricks talks to military men, and the military men saw a devastating fiasco in Iraq. He found military failures, congressional failures, and most of all, failure from the White House. Now Tom Ricks is tracking the surge and looking for light, but fearing a national tragedy. Up next on Point, Fiasco author Thomas Ricks on the path and consequences of the Iraq War. Joining me now in the studio, and it's great to have him, is Tom Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning military correspondent for The Washington Post. Before joining the Post in 2000, he covered the military for The Wall Street Journal for 17 years. He's the author of A Soldier's Duty, Making the Corps, and the acclaimed and best-selling book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. Tom Ricks, welcome. Great to have you.
Hello.
We're going to go straight to the surge, and we're going to go just as big from there as you and our listeners want to go today in our consideration of this war and where we stand in it. Let's go straight to the headlines, though, if we may, Tom. Here's Senator John McCain, presidential candidate, Republican, Arizona, in Baghdad at a news conference yesterday, saying the situation there is improving and the security plan is working.
I believe that we have a new strategy that is making progress, and it's not to say that things are well everywhere in Iraq. Far from it. We have a long way to go. We read every day about suicide bombings, kidnappings, rocket attacks, and other terrible acts. And I'm not saying that mission is accomplished or last throws or a few dead enders. But what we don't read about every day and what is new since the surge began is a lot of the good news.
A lot of good news we don't hear about, says Senator John McCain in Baghdad yesterday. Tom Ricks, what do you make of Senator McCain's assessment of the surge? It's working.
I was kind of sorry to hear him say it because I have a lot of respect for him. And he does have a feel for the military situation, I think, more than most members of the U.S. Senate. I think it's simply too early to call the ball on what's happening in Iraq right now. There's a lot of counterintuitive signs. For example, a sharp increase in U.S. casualties would not necessarily be a bad sign.
Because
General Petraeus, the new U.S. commander in Iraq, is putting all these troops out in these outposts across the city instead of having them behind big walls and big forward operating bases. If those new combat outposts are effective, they will be attacked. And so one sign of this change strategy being effective would be increased attacks on American troops. If you're ineffective, if you're irrelevant, the enemy doesn't attack you. He likes where you are. If you are having an effect, if you are changing the security situation on the ground, he will respond. And so I think General Petraeus would agree, I think, it's much too early to say this thing is working. The important thing about the surge, by the way, is not the increase in troop numbers, because it isn't really a surge. It's a slow trickle. A surge is a big, fast change. Putting in an extra brigade a month, 5,000 troops a month over the course of 6 months, is not a surge. In fact, once you increase to that level over the course of 6 months, we will not even have as many troops as we've had in Iraq in previous times when we were up to 160,000 troops. What's really significant here in Iraq, and what I think Senator McCain is focusing on properly, is the change posture that General Petraeus is having the troops have, getting them out of the bases, getting them out living among the people. And it's much too early to say that's working or not working.
Higher casualties in Baghdad, you say, may in fact be a sign that something's working. But, of course, the casualties are up right around the country. The leadership in Baghdad, the U.S. military leadership, talking about the action being squeezed out. Big bombings in Kirkuk over the weekend. We saw last week in Tal Afar, huge bombing and slaughter, biggest bombing in the 4 years of the war there.
What happened in Tal Afar is really worrisome, and I think much more significant than what we've seen happening in Baghdad. Tal Afar is a city up in northwestern Iraq. I was there almost exactly a year ago. And the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment had done a terrific job of bringing security to that city, taking it back for some really nasty terrorists. Unfortunately, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment rotated out under U.S. military policy. People go out for a year and come back. A smaller unit was put in. and we seem to have lost control of that situation. A year ago, President Bush hailed it in a speech as Tal Afar as a model for what we want to do in Iraq. And in many ways, what we're doing in Baghdad now is a bigger version of what we did in Tal Afar. But what we've seen in Tal Afar with that huge bombing, actually a couple of bombings that killed at least a couple hundred people, it looks like, was Tal Afar has gone from being an example of the best we can do, which is clear, hold, and build, to the worst we can do, which is arming Iraqi security forces who then use those weapons against other Iraqis.
And of course, that's what happened after the bombing. It appears as though police went house to house, dragged Sunnis, Shia police dragged out Sunnis, killed them, boom, and up went the death rate.
Exactly. So it's gone from being the best we could do to our worst nightmare, which is we are simply adding fuel to the fire.
There are so many questions here. And Americans now being asked to judge between starkly different views of the war. Democrats were saying we've got to set up a timetable to get out of there, to bring Iraqis to step up. Republicans saying we have to hang in there. Your judgment last year famously was the military effort to that point a fiasco. Has that judgment changed? Have we learned? Have we turned a corner? Has experience taught? Are we doing things better or not?
We are doing things better. Strikingly, what you have now is the dissidence of 03-04. General Petraeus, the new ambassador, Ryan Crocker. These are the people who were arguing for a different way several years ago, have now been put in charge. We are operating very differently. As I said, the troop numbers really don't matter, but the different posture does matter. The problem is it's probably too little too late. If you'd done this in early 04 and said, General Petraeus, what you're doing up in northern Iraq with the 101st Airborne is great. Come and do it for the whole country. But now this war has now gone on longer than our involvement in World War II. The enemy has learned a lot from us. It's a very smart and almost devilish enemy in some ways. And in many ways, all we're doing is still squeezing the toothpaste around the country. And the situation in Anbar province gets better, so al-Qaeda moves to the northern Sunni triangle into Kirkuk and Mosul and Tal Afar. The situation in Baghdad gets better, but you see more violence east of the capital in Diyala province. So I actually still think we're basically in a one-year period where all the other players are watching Uncle Sam play his last chips. And they're all kind of taking a deep breath, standing back and watching this major player expend his resources. And I think this fall is when we'll really begin to understand what's happening, right around the month of Ramadan, which historically has seen a spike in violence every year. If this thing is really working, we'll know that by, say, mid-October.
You talk with a lot of people inside the military. Give us a sense of the chatter there. Are they saying, hey, you know, maybe General David Petraeus can pull this out? Are they saying he hasn't got a snowball's chance? And what would pull it out mean? How's it being assessed on the inside?
What you hear again and again is, if anybody can do this, General Petraeus can. But I say, do you think he can? And generally what you hear is 10% chance, 20% chance. What doing it would mean would be changing long-term trends in Baghdad and Iraq so that violence appears to be going down generally and people start feeling secure. And people turn to Iraqi forces and their American allies for protection. Right now, people turn to the militias and the insurgents for protection. Iraq, and especially Baghdad, is the pure Hobbesian state. Baghdad today is a series of armed camps of five or six square blocks where they've pulled up rubble and dead cars to block off
the
all the exits except for one. And there's one guy standing out there in blue jeans and a red flannel shirt holding an AK-47. And he's the security guard, or he might be the militia, or he might be both. But he's protecting that little neighborhood. One of the problems is the Shiite-dominated police sometimes go into the Sunni enclaves and say, we're the police, we're here to clear out all the heavy weapons. And they're very polite about it. And then that night, the Shiite militia shows up and kills all the men.
Comes in behind the disarming.
Yeah.
You've described this war last year as a fiasco. The word I hear coming to the fore more with you these days is a tragedy. But yet you're describing here some potential, some improvement, potential signs of hope. Yet you use this word tragedy. Tragedy is a very big word, national tragedy. Why that one?
It's very difficult to find examples of losing the strategic initiative and then regaining it. Once you've lost the initiative in a war, it's the hardest thing to regain it. And we lost the initiative in the spring of 03, in the two or three months after the fall of Baghdad, the fall of the statue, when the Secretary of Defense dismissed the looting as stuff happens, when he refused to recognize that insurgency was being created, and when the generals used extremely counterproductive tactics that inflamed Iraqi public opinion against the Americans and really helped create the insurgencies, helped it with its recruiting and financing and arming problems, which any new insurgency has. I still think it's a tragedy. It's hard to see a good outcome in this. It's not going to end as you like it. Shakespearean tragedies have five acts. I think we're only in Act 3. Act 3 is the Petraeus phase. Act 4 will be probably the American drawdown in some form. I don't think we'll get out, but I think we will draw down our presence in 08. And Act 5 probably will be the regional consequences. And I don't think they're going to be good. They're not good right now. And I think it ends in a five-act play like Hamlet or Othello or Macbeth or King Lear, which is, say, bloody and messy and difficult. And it's a tragedy. I think it's a good thing to understand as a tragedy because it tells you there really are no good options. Once you grasp that, you say, okay, let's talk about least bad options. None of them particularly palatable. But what is the least damaging to the Iraqi people, to the region, and to the American interest?
John McCain has been in Baghdad talking about what's going on there, saying he's seeing some very cautious reason for optimism, his words. Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, was along with him. At the same news conference yesterday, Senator Graham said it would be a grave error to set a deadline for pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq. Let's listen.
I think you see four people here who believe more now than ever, it would be a huge mistake to set a deadline, because it is working. There are signs of progress. We're doing now what we should have done 3 years ago. And if you set a deadline now, it will undercut everything positive that's going on. That's not me saying that. That's every soldier I've talked to today. That's the Iraqi police commander who said, please stay with us. Things are getting better.
Senator Lindsey Graham in Baghdad. This weekend with Senator John McCain, we'll talk about that with Tom Rooks. I want to get our listeners right in here first, if I may. Dory's calling from Fairfield, Iowa. Dory, you're on the air with Tom Rooks.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Your guest, Mr. Rooks, did kind of answer my question a little bit. I live in a community. There's many people living here from all over the world. And one of my close friends has, we kind of have a running debate. And she thinks the whole anti-war cry of, you know, bring the troops home is, you know, very disrespectful to the Iraqi people. And when I heard about this so-called surge, you know, I thought, well, you know, if they could pacify the country and bring, you know, the end to the suffering of the Iraqi people, I'm all for it. But it sounds like your guest said that that is not what is happening. And I wanted to know, you know, my thought is that the American troops should leave the country and somehow rally an international force, you know, led by the Arab states, and I'd like your guest's outlook on that. Or what does he see? How do we stop the suffering of the Iraqis?
Dory, we'll pick it up. Thank you. Tom Rooks.
It's actually a good question, because a lot of people talk about this. Why don't we put in a UN force or an international force? The answer is most of the Arab world vigorously opposes the U.S. presence in Iraq. And a U.N. force is likely to be ineffectual. The U.N. doesn't like what's happening in Iraq. They just got bombed again recently. The U.N. was bombed severely in the summer of 2003 in Baghdad when the Canal Hotel, their headquarters, was knocked down. And inside the U.N., that event is viewed as their 9/11. So the U.N. has really felt burned by the situation in Iraq. I don't think you're going to see any sort of effective international force. Anything that happens, I think, is going to have to, militarily, is going to have to be done by the U.S. It leads to a good point, I think, which is people talk about, well, why don't we just get out? Well, if you get out, you are going to have consequences in Iraq, and those need to be thought through. Or why don't we just break up the country into three parts? Okay. Well, what does that mean? You're going to have some sort of no man's land between those areas to keep them separate. To keep them from fighting each other.
This is the idea of a Sunni area, Shia area, Kurdish area.
Exactly. Who patrols those? Do American troops patrol it? Well, then you're going to have American troops in a more difficult situation. I think we're probably going to wind up in some sort of containment posture where we pull back to the borders and try to keep Iraq's civil war from becoming a regional war. But if you do that and just stand back and let Iraqis slaughter each other, as one general said to me, what a great recruiting poster for al-Qaeda. Secondly, if you didn't like the Iraq mission, you're going to hate the containment mission, which is this messy, difficult situation where American troops are dying, an ambiguous, open-ended, difficult mission. So that's what I mean in saying there are really no good options here, but there are bad options, and we need to think through what each of them means.
So take us from there, then, and the debate that Dory has with her neighbor. I mean, you're describing a kind of damned if you do, damned if you don't. Lindsey Graham says, and we heard him right there, if you set a deadline now, and of course this is the debate in Washington, it will undercut everything positive that's going on. How do you look at the debate over timelines, deadlines, withdrawal schedules?
I look at the congressional debate and the White House response as ants on a log floating down a river, arguing which way the log should go. And they're having no effect on it. The log is going to float down the way the river is carrying it. We, in many ways, are not controlling events in Iraq. Events are controlling us.
But the U.S. troop presence, that surely is something that Washington can make decisions on, good or bad.
Sure, you can make
in or out.
But okay, how many ants do you want to put on the log? You know, or how many ants should we take off the log? The log's still going to go in the direction the log is going in.
Doesn't matter if the U.S. is there or not?
May not be. This one argument you hear from some U.S. officers, which is, look, a big civil war here is inevitable. If you believe it's inevitable, then all we're doing is postponing the inevitable and having suffering and losses of American troops during that period. Mm. So the moral thing to do is to stop trying to postpone the inevitable.
These are U.S. military officers saying
I've heard that argument. And we should just step back and let this thing happen. There's other people who say, no, let's stay in there. My point is that the congressional debate about something happening in 2008 is like talking about the next century. Events are moving so swiftly on the ground in Iraq as things change, as political lineups move, as militias realign themselves, if Sistani dies, all these things are out there. And to talk about 08 is almost irrelevant. We're going to know, I think, by this fall, the direction of Iraq and the outcome of Iraq.
How will we know? What might we learn?
Right about the time of the end of Ramadan, the holy month, which is mid-October, I think we'll have a sense of, look, has the changed American posture had any effect? Has the Iraqi government been able to achieve any sort of political reconciliation? And those trends are not particularly good. We see no real indication of reconciliation between Sunnis and Shiites. Rather, we see Sunni ministers leaving the government. Mm. We see a real hardening of positions. We see Shiites basically saying, look, we have won this war. The Americans are useful chumps to keep around while we sort out our internal differences and consolidate our hold. But this is now a Shiite government, and the Sunnis can like it or lump it. So I think you're seeing a hardening of positions rather than a reconciliation. If it's going to change, we'll see it in the next few months. If anybody can do it, it'll be this team of General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker. But I don't hear a lot of people giving me better than 50-50 odds on that.
And there you see the debate then in Washington is kind of irrelevant here.
Basically fiber-free. I was asked by one of my bosses to call what they call truth squad, a recent congressional debate, sort out the facts.
Yeah.
And I didn't find a toehold. There weren't really a lot of facts to work with. It was a lot of opinion back and forth. One reason is that for the last 4 years, Congress essentially abdicated its oversight responsibilities. It didn't act as a co-equal branch of government and hold hearings and put out reports that establish a fact base for discussion. Mm-hmm. And so it really was a content-free debate in many ways on both sides because it was just opinions flying back and forth without anybody being able to say, you know, as we held hearings on X, we see that. For example, nobody can tell you exactly how much this war cost. But the best estimate is around $2 billion a week. But last time I looked, the Pentagon still wouldn't sort out Afghanistan numbers from Iraq numbers.
Right.
And so we don't really know for sure. I don't know how many Americans have died in Iraq. I can tell you how many American troops have died. But we've never been able to pull out solid numbers on contractors. Mm. And there's a lot of American contractors there. Mm. There are almost as many civilian contractors in Iraq as there are U.S. troops, although many of the civilian contractors are Iraqi. The key program in Iraq, training and equipping Iraqi security forces, Congress has never held a series of hearings on that. They've recently started to look at that. But the fact base that would say, here's the long-term trends, here's how this works, here's how many Iraqi battalions are effective right now, it's very difficult to pull that information together.
This goes to your bigger theme, your great theme of a kind of systems failure in the United States behind this war from the conception and certainly behind its prosecution. Do you see the country turning the corner on that? You've pointed out The military failures, General Franks and others that you pointed out, the congressional failures. Of course, there's the White House failures with the basic conception and the attitude. Mm-hmm. Are we rounding a corner on those? Have we begun to learn those lessons, or does it take the full five-act tragedy to bring that about?
Well, and I would add the media failure,
yes,
the run-up to the war,
yes,
and the intelligence failure. I think Iraq happened because of 9/11, not because there was any connection between 9/11 and Iraq, but because 9/11 knocked this country off balance. And it's only now, 5 years later, that we're beginning to regain our equilibrium somewhat, especially in our political system. But I don't think we fully regained that equilibrium. And there are structural problems in the Congress. The Republicans have not wanted to criticize their own president. The Democrats don't seem intellectually equipped to really discuss the war in serious terms. They're very hesitant about, for example, criticizing generals, because they think they're not supporting the troops. Mm-hmm. They don't understand that one way to support the troops is to criticize the generals.
And in previous wars, generals have been tossed out one after another, American generals.
Yeah, I mean, this is actually something people would say that my book is a book of liberal opinion. I say hardly. It's in many ways a book of conservative fact. It's conservative in the sense that it's a call for return to American traditions and values. The Iraq War is a really untraditional war in terms of American
history. A war
history.
Of choice, a war where generals stay in even when things are going badly.
A war also launched preemptively on false premises. The first ever American occupation of an Arab state. The first ever extended ground war overseas using an all-volunteer force. And also the first war I can think of where Congress really has withdrawn entirely for several years from examination of the war. During the Civil War, there was a committee on the Congress so intrusive it antagonized President Lincoln. Harry Truman.
Was it of the opposite party? Was it a divided Washington? So
much of it was, but actually it sometimes it's in the same party. Harry Truman, during World War II, Democratic senator, made his name by holding hearings in defense contracting.
Corruption and all the rest.
Fulbright, in the Vietnam War, famously a member of the president's party, held extensive hearings on the conduct of the war.
And the Republican Congress under the Republican President George W. Bush in this war? Not there, you're saying.
No. Really AWOL, as was in many ways the military leadership. I don't want to just bash Congress, although I think in many ways Congress is the hidden villain of my book. The military leadership kind of put itself off limits to criticism, and the political people were afraid to attack them. And so you've had these generals really go unexamined. Mm. And when the generals don't ask themselves the tough questions, another American tradition, by the way, it's the role of Congress to step in and ask those tough questions.
Tom, let's take a call from Northampton. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I have two questions. The first is, we're not willing to set a deadline to get out of Iraq, but we hear we're making progress. What key milestones do you feel that we need to achieve to have our soldiers return home? I don't feel that the country has a common collective appreciation of what needs to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
And my second question is, you mentioned it briefly that we know the body count for U.S. soldiers. We don't know them for U.S. contractors. And on the news, we never hear the collective body count for Iraqi soldiers and Iraqi civilians.
Kelly,
why is that?
Kelly, let us take those. Thanks, Tom.
A bunch of good questions. You know, you can't rely on broadcast media to tell you anything. You've got to really go to the print media. I'm teasing Tom here a bit. The Washington Post carries that data every Saturday on our foreign
Iraqi
page.
Deaths?
Yes. We carry...
Civilian?
We carry, yeah. The best estimate of Iraqi deaths.
Where does your number stand now, the Washington Post number?
I don't know.
Okay.
I kind of wince every time I look at it and close my eyes. Mm-hmm. On your questions, what are the key metrics to pay attention to? I think you generally would settle on these three. First, political reconciliation, as I mentioned. Second, a decline in violence, especially a decline in sectarian violence. And especially, most especially, a decline in official violence, where people in uniforms, whether especially police, carry out militia-like actions. And third, and this is something that the American government doesn't talk about much, I would look for a return of the Iraqi exiles. There are now an estimated 2 million Iraqis who have fled the country in the last 5 years. And it's especially worrisome because these disproportionately tend to be doctors, lawyers, professors, journalists, which is to say the middle-class types who are the glue of a new democracy. They have left the country. The people left are the men of the gun.
So watch the flow. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is on point. But I think Kelly is reaching for something there, Tom, some notion, or your notion anyway, of when an exit would be possible. Now, let's say, you know, by some miracle, all three of these things happened. The flow went the other way. The violence declined. You had a reconciliation, peace, and love, obviously. But you're saying those are not likely. So given the unlikelihood, then where's the withdrawal point?
I don't think there is one. Given the U.S. goals and strategy, I think we're going to have troops in Iraq for a long time.
What does long time mean to you?
Oh, a decade or two.
Troops at scale?
No, I think we'll get them down to about 40,000 probably within the next few years, but we're going to find it very difficult to get fewer than that. When I was writing this book, I'd look out the window every day at these kids who would march up from the kindergarten near my house to a daycare center around 3:30, and I would look at them and think one of those kids is going to fight and die in Iraq.
Those are kindergartners who grow up to still.
Yeah.
That long.
Yeah.
You think the American public will support it? We saw over the weekend this big story on Matthew Dowd, the former Bush supporter, headed up the 2004 campaign, is now broken with President Bush. And he was quoted saying, "If the American public says they're done with something, our leaders have to understand what they want." Dowd said, "They're saying, get out of Iraq." So you watch the military, but politics do factor in here. How do you see that?
Absolutely. And it was striking to me that one of the things that really seems to have spurred the change of heart in Matthew Dowd is the fact that his son is a soldier deploying to Iraq.
Arabic linguist.
And I really give credence to those parents. I'm friends with some people like that, and they pay really close attention. They really have a feel for this, and they are putting their flesh and blood on the line in this terrifically difficult situation. I have a lot of respect for people who are going through that and thinking through that.
Maria's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Maria, you're on the air with Tom Ricks.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are things in Iowa?
Oh, just fine, just fine. Listen, I read your book. I absolutely loved it. It's an extremely fine book. I've been recommending it to everyone. And one question puzzles me, not that you recommended it, but that Bush did. Why on earth have we got your best general, David Petraeus, in Iraq managing the surge or managing the troops, and we've got your worst general backing him up, Raymond Odierno? I mean, you said he was not just bad but counterproductive in the way he managed his troops.
Close reader, Tom. What do you say?
It's a great question. Thank you for reading the book. This goes to the general question of how Army generals have handled this war. They have operated almost as a club in which, sure, they might criticize each other eternally, but they don't really like the external discussion of that. There's also the sense of almost fairness. Everybody has to have a turn. And I've had some screaming arguments with friends of mine in the military about this.
Talk about kindergarten.
Yeah, I mean, just for example, I was just doing a big study of the U.S. in Sicily in World War II, and it's quite striking that Eisenhower, Patton, Lucian Truscott made a series of rather grave mistakes in handling the invasion of Sicily. But it was absolutely necessary for them to learn through this way so they could do D-Day a year later. Mm. If we had current policy in place after Sicily, they all would have gone home to the war college and somebody else would have gotten a turn to handle D-Day, and D-Day would have failed.
Robert Gates has fired people over Walter Reed. Why would he, you know, be playing musical chairs, take your turn in Iraq?
Well, there's a bit of a change there because Gates is new. But we have had a total changeover in Iraq recently. We've had Petraeus put in, Odierno put in, a new ambassador. We have a new Army chief of staff coming in. We even have a new Army secretary destined to come in. And, of course, since December, we've had a new defense secretary. That said, the Army is kind of in lockstep, and one of the warning signs of a military in wartime is that it continues peacetime processes, peacetime promotion. And so you see guys pulled out of Iraq because I ask why, oh, he has to go to the war college now. And my attitude is, no, let's get the best people out there and keep them out there. Tell them you're there for the duration. You're an effective commander. You demonstrated it. Stay out there. And you're kind of seeing that with Petraeus. He's pulled in some of the most experienced, best commanders, people like Pete Mansour and H.R. McMaster, very adept and effective colonels. So we are seeing a bit of a change. But Odierno's presence is the result of the Army saying, nope, it's his turn, and we're putting him out there.
Tom, if this war and its experience has not been enough to whack us sort of upside the head and wake us up to the to the necessities of war and changing process, what will? Does it take Act 4 and 5 of your tragedy to do that? What's the problem here?
I think it probably does. What you have is a lot of the post-Vietnam strengths of the military, the rebuilding, turn out also to be weaknesses in different circumstances. The post-Vietnam Army made battalion command the measure of generalship. And so guys who were good battalion commanders are presumed to be good generals. In many ways, they're the opposite. And also, they really have not had the help they need from Congress, of oversight, of asking tough questions of these guys. And they didn't want to ask themselves a lot of the tough questions. One of the things we've seen, and again with the Army in Iraq, is rash optimism, unjustified optimism in their assessment of events. Remember, the original U.S. Army war plan for Iraq had us down to 30,000 troops by the fall of 2003.
Right.
Well, here we are nearly 4 years later, and we're still at 140,000 troops. Again and again, the Army has thought, we'll be out of this in a couple of years. I think they've never really been able to grasp some of the realities on the ground. I think they are doing much more of that now.
Was that rash optimism something unique, something new to this war? Did Americans not historically operate on a sense that where the power will do it? Was there some fundamental worldview that shifted a little bit that leads to that?
I think it was kind of built into today's Army. They'll never tell you there's problems, there's only challenges. Mm-hmm. They'll tell you failure is not an option. Guess what? Failure is an option, and especially if you don't think it is. You really need to think soberly and seriously. Clausewitz says the only job of the supreme commander, of a top commander in any situation, the only job is to understand the nature of the conflict in which you are engaged. Top U.S. generals repeatedly failed in that sole task, to understand the conflict that I'm fighting. Petraeus, I think, understands very well the nature of the conflict in which he's engaged. He demonstrated that back when he had the 101st Airborne up north in Iraq in 03-04. But we've had a lot of generals who basically didn't understand the situation they were in, because if they had, they wouldn't have used tactics that were counterproductive.
Let me go to Mohammed in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Mohammed, you're on the air. Hello, Mohammed, are you there? Let's take another call from Simsbury, Connecticut, and Mike. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a quick question for your guest, and that is, to what extent does he believe we are in the present situation overseas in Iraq and in the world in general due to the fact that Americans have a very poor grasp of history, our own history as a nation as well as world history, which of course extends to current day policymakers because they were a part of the American educational system. And I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. Tom Ricks.
I think it's certainly part of the problem, the failure to understand quite what we're getting into. This really striking thing about the current commanders to senior people in Iraq is they do understand this history. There's a really unique bunch of guys out there right now. It's probably the most exclusive club in the world, which is people who have served a tour or two in Iraq in usually commanding battalions or brigades, who also have PhDs from very good universities, many of them in history. Mm. So, for example, Petraeus's advisor on economics is a Colonel Mike Meese, son of the former Attorney General, by the way, PhD from Princeton. Colonel H.R. McMaster, one of the counterinsurgency advisors, PhD from the University of North Carolina.
Does this serve them or not?
I think it does very well. On my last long reporting trip in Iraq a year ago, I was just sort of trying to sort out who were the effective commanders and why. And asking this question, I actually tripped across a secret Army study of exactly that question. Who were the effective commanders? And what you notice is the most effective commanders were guys who had civilian advanced degrees. And I think that was because what the Army had taught commanders really didn't work in Iraq. And if that's all you had in your toolbox intellectually, you would just keep on doing it because you had nowhere else to go. But guys like Petraeus, who himself has a PhD from Princeton in international affairs and the study of the Vietnam War, had other tools in the toolbox. They're able to say, you know, what the Army has taught me here ain't working. So what else do I know? How do I think critically about the situation? How do I assess it myself?
But what about the broader public? Mike's pointing there as well. This war occurred because a nation was convinced it was necessary. It goes on those terms.
It is a striking question to ask. Did we really think we could go in and, with a relatively small military force, alter one of the world's oldest cultures? And it actually is striking to me, H.R. McMaster understood mm-hmm. this. He took his officers out on a staff ride, a military study, with Iraqi officers of the battlefield in which Alexander defeated the Persian Empire. Mm-hmm. And one of the lessons, I think, was, first of all, respect for the Iraqis, but second of all, to convey the sense to his own people that we are one of the world's youngest cultures in the middle of one of the world's oldest. Be very careful about overestimating your ability to alter it.
Mike, thanks for your call. Let's get another Mike on from Boston. Mike, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, Tom. Yeah. Regarding the predictions that were made before the war that, we'd be down to 30,000 troops by now, and one of the more impressive ones was that the oil would pay for the reconstruction of Iraq. But we never hear about the oil anymore, and I'm just wondering, do you have an idea where the oil is?
The oil and paying for this war. Tom Ricks.
You're actually citing one of Paul Wolfowitz's greatest hits, of which there were many. Hard to imagine you need more troops to occupy than to invade. Occupation will pay for itself with oil.
This is the former Deputy Secretary of Defense under Donald Rumsfeld, under President Bush.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Oil has basically chugged along at the same level for several years. It's been plagued partly because the pipeline keeps on getting blown up. The pipelines keep on getting attacked. And it's not necessarily the insurgents who do it. There's a lot of people in Iraq who make a lot of money from the illegal oil exports and smuggling fuel back and forth. And the pipeline is not their friend. And so they tend to blow it up. Also, the American approach initially was to pay local tribesmen to protect it, but they'd only pay them if there were attacks in the area. So the local tribesmen figured out, how do you get paid around
attack,
here?
Attack, defend.
Yeah. And so one of the things the smart commanders did was they would only pay, we'll say, we'll pay you if there are no attacks on the pipeline this month.
Protection now, money, but better that than
exactly. At least things start working. Mm-hmm. You do have to make some compromises with the culture. One of the things that bothers me a bit is when Americans talk about Iraqi corruption. Mm-hmm. Well, you need to understand that from an Iraqi context. Maybe that guy had to pay several thousand dollars to get that job. So maybe his taking a bribe is simply his deal with the economic system. Another thing is feeling that Iraqis are somehow evil because they cut deals with the insurgency. Well, sometimes a police chief is trying to stay alive, and he knows his three predecessors have been killed. So maybe he'll cut a quiet deal. And sometimes we need to understand that these are the things that people need to do simply to stay alive in this very difficult environment.
But $2 billion a week is a lot of money by any superpower standard, and someone's going to have to pay it. You've been paying attention to that. If it's not Iraqi oil, remind us of what is going on in that ledger.
Well, here we have the Chinese to thank, because we're not paying for this war. The Chinese are. And we're fighting a war in which we are not paying taxes to pay for it, in which Chinese buying American bonds are subsidizing the war. And our children will be paying that back probably for the rest of their lives.
Cents on the dollar. I mean, this is not small money, even spread over generations.
Yeah, this is a lot of money. I mean, I think, your kids should look in their wallets and see the money flying out for the rest of their lives. They're earning income. I don't know how much it's going to be, $1,000 a year from each person or something, but it's a lot of money.
David's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. David, you're on the air.
Mr. Ricks, I loved your book. I was in Iraq myself in 2004, 2005, that winter.
In the service, David, or what took you?
Correct, yes, I'm mm-hmm. military.
Yep.
Can I ask what unit?
Pardon?
Can I ask what unit you're with?
I can't, because we're going to be going back, and I can't for operational reasons.
Okay.
I'm a civil affairs guy. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious what you thought about the prospects of the PRTs, and specifically what you think about the fact that the State Department is trying to fill these with military volunteers.
These are the provincial reconstruction teams.
Correct.
Is it new that they're military volunteers instead of civilian in these? Or what are you pointing to there, David?
Recently, what's going on is the State Department is finding a dearth of people that are willing to do this on their own.
They have to be ordered to do it.
So they're asking military people to volunteer for it.
Well, actually, you can't order State Department people to do it.
Right, but you can order military.
Exactly. I think one thing we've all realized here is just how small the State Department is. As I understand it, there are more musical band members in the U.S. Army than there are Foreign Service officers.
In the world.
Yeah. It's rather tiny, the Foreign Service, compared to the U.S. military. And also, they don't want to go. Well, a friend of mine at the State Department mentioned to me that posts that used to be considered not really appealing, Algiers or Tunis or something, now everybody's sticking their hands up for.
Beats Iraq.
Because it sure beats being sent to Iraq.
But David's saying, you know, is this a good thing? Will this work? What about the reconstruction effort?
This is actually a pet project of Zalmay Khalilzad, who until recently was the U.S. ambassador in Iraq, previously was the ambassador in Afghanistan, and found the PRT concept worked very well in Afghanistan. It doesn't appear to me to be working as well in Iraq, partly because most of Afghanistan, most of the time, is pretty quiet. All the fighting and bombing really is down in two areas, the Pakistani-Afghan border and the Arazgan province area in southern Afghanistan, where the Taliban really are headquartered. Iraq, I don't think, has enough stability for those PRTs to be effective in many places. It's just such a different situation. The other problem I have is the U.S. military keeps on saying, where's the rest of the U.S. government? And when I say to the U.S. military, are you willing to take orders from a civilian? They say, hell no, that's not my chain of command. Mm-hmm. Well, that means they want the rest of the U.S. government on their terms.
Mm-hmm.
I think until you see a brigade commander willing to take orders from a PRT leader, you're really not going to get genuine government cooperation and effectiveness. Part of the problem here is we have never had a unified structure in Iraq. And every study of this says you must have, in this sort of situation, have one person in charge, and that person has to be a civilian because ultimately the decisions are political, not military. Yet we've always had this bifurcated structure, a military command structure and a civilian command structure. And just because of where they sit, sometimes they have different goals. And I think frequently the two command structures have been at odds in Iraq.
Tom Ricks, our time grows short. What if we just leave?
I think a lot of people want to do that, and we may. I think it's a moral position to take. I think we need to talk through what the consequences of those would be. The consequences almost certainly would not be good. Yet at the same time, the consequences of every other option I can see that I've heard of are also bad.
How do you see the consequences of full departure?
I think you'd have a full-out civil war, bloodier than you have now. And I think you would see regional intervention. Iran is already there in spades. I think Syria would be there. You probably would wind up with a civil war, a regional war, fought on the streets of Baghdad between Shiite bodies and Saudi Arabian money. Up in the north, you'd probably have Turkey intervene against the Kurds. Remember, the Kurds are the largest nation in the world that doesn't have a country.
Do you end up with a hostile or friendly government in Iraq?
I think you probably wind up with a fractured Iraq in which Western Iraq becomes a no-man's land, very receptive to al-Qaeda. Northern Iraq becomes Kurdistan, an embattled country at odds with Turkey, a member of NATO, and so an ally of ours. And in the south, the Shiites create a bulwark and are forced by circumstances to really align themselves closely with Iran.
And the spillover, Saudi Arabia, beyond?
I think it would shake our allies in the region. It could well lead to... It certainly would lead to higher oil prices, much higher oil prices. It probably would lead to turbulence across the Arabian Peninsula. You could see governments fall. And in many ways, you probably would further the goals of al-Qaeda, which we really, I think, have done, unfortunately, since 9/11.
What a box we're in. This is what you call the tragedy.
Yes.
Tom Ricks, we appreciate your reporting all the way through this. Just got a couple seconds. Your sense of the military spirits in the middle of this box?
A little bit worrisome right now. Pretty good, surprisingly good up to now, because it's a small, cohesive force. But this third tour in the Army, this third year out there, the prospect of being out there for an extended 18-month tour is really, I think, starting to worry families. And we're seeing mid-career NCOs, the sergeants who are the backbone of the force, bailing out.
Tom Ricks, thanks for your tour with us today. Tom Ricks' most recent book, Fiasco. It's great to have you. Thanks for being here, Tom.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.